button. There we go. This is Jane Poulin, and this is the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, conducting an interview with Lynn Turner, former chief accountant at the SEC, among other things. We'll ask him to give his background briefly as we start here. And also with me is Jeff Smith from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Lynn, you're familiar with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and the regulation that introduced us, and you're familiar with our...
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're familiar with our mandate.
A couple times, yes.
And we've talked a couple times before.
Yeah.
What we wanted to talk about primarily today really is kind of to get your view on accounting during the crisis. And that could be either where accounting kind of played a role during the crisis, or there might have been things that occurred during the crisis that highlighted anomalies or perceived flaws in accounting. Anything that's really accounting related. So we're looking for the role of accounting during the crisis. But then if at the end of our conversation on accounting, do you have more broad-based commentary or advice on things that we should make sure we look at, either in terms of accounting or any other related topics, we'd be happy to get that advice as well.
Okay. Where would you like to start?
Well, actually, one place that might be good would be the article that you and Professor Portnoy did. We talked a little bit about the article before, but if you could maybe expand on the views that are in that article, if you still hold those views about recognition of all the assets and liabilities of corporations, and what that would mean for example, for derivatives accounting.
Yeah, if you go back to the 1970s, as securitizations started to take off or grow in terms of volume, an accountant started to take a look at it. They came up with some authoritative guidelines at the time in the form of an issues paper from the AICPA, which was authoritative in the area. And so accountants would have to follow that guidance when auditing, preparing and auditing financials and issuing an opinion on. And what that guidance said was that when you look at securitizations at that time, most of them were purely financing of the receivables that were being put into the pools. And as a result, even though the form might be a sale, the reality was economically it was financing, and so you would have to include the assets on your balance sheet and along with the debt financing.
Right.
So everything stayed on balance sheet, if you will. And under pressure from industry, in earlier part of the 1980s.
And would that be all industry or particular industries like
financial? Yeah, Wall Street. In fact, at the time, I was serving in the national office Coopers and Libran in New York City. And FASB debated and deliberated a standard that undid that accounting that had been in the earlier standard done by the AICPA. When I say undid, the new FASB standard, statement number 77,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden allowed people to take the assets and debt off the balance sheet.
So
it's called sales of receivables with recourse.
So what previously would have been accounted for as a financing and been on balance sheet now gets sale accounting, gets off balance sheet treatment.
Yeah.
Kind of similar to broad-based what we have for different models. Now we have some things that are technically financings per the accounting literature end up on balance sheet.
Right.
And things that are technically sales and not financings are off balance sheet.
Yep. And this is a point that in a recent letter in the last week to Senator Corker, that the former FDIC chairman Bill Isaacs, much of which I disagree with what's in that letter, but nonetheless he does highlight how the FASB let the horse out of the barn and let these financial institutions and companies take all this off, take the assets and financing off the balance sheet and hide, in essence, from the public what was going on and the true extent of debt and leverage that these companies were getting into. And since the assets came off the balance sheet, it also allowed them to get away with putting up less capital against the assets than what they really needed. So it was really a terrible standard. And just to give
you... So that was a recent letter this week?
Yeah.
And was it specifically talking about financings versus
sales?
It did
mention the specific issue. It talks about the mark-to-market accounting, which is something that he crows about every single day of the year. But, you know, it does talk about the problem with the FASB having let them take it off the balance sheet. And his complaint, well, now it's making them bring them on the balance sheet and all of a sudden crank up capital in the middle of
the 166, 167.
Yeah. and he's right, but the bottom line is they never should have been off balance sheet. We never should have let people run without the capital that they needed during, which is in essence what happened and obviously contributed to the crisis. But at the time, to give you a flavor for how people viewed this change, I was in, like I said, the National Office of Coopers at the time. I dealt with Wall Street at the time. I was in a position, in essence, where I was working solely on Wall Street with Wall Street investment banking firms as they did these type of transactions. We had an arrangement with them.
Okay. And I would you have been consulting on technical accounting matters, or were you in a structuring deal? Structuring deals, all that stuff.
A, B, C, and D, all the above.
At the time, we didn't have the Chinese wall now between...
And in fact, what happened was we had about 25 firms on Wall Street that retained the firm to go help them understand, get educated on these transactions, figure out how to put them together and everything. And the firm identified one person that did that full time in the national office. Bingo.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I did that. And when Statement 77 came out, I remember it very clearly because Goldman Sachs had asked me if I would stay home that morning up in Connecticut. And as soon as the first copy came off the printer press, I grabbed it.
Tom Green.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
I love your article, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So we're on Tape Recorder, which is fine. Lynn's giving us a fascinating background on structured finance and off-balance sheet treatment. Actually, I hadn't realized that he was in national office at Deloitte.
Coopers.
I should remember that. He was in national office at Coopers and one of the first guys primarily responsible to Wall Street for structuring. So I hadn't realized that. So that's great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, let me just sit in for a minute or two. I'm going to have to check for something else. But
so anyway, so that morning, Goldman had asked if I stay at home up in Connecticut until the first copy of this new standard, which would, for the first time, allow off-balance sheet financing to come off the printing press at the FASB. And I remember I literally went over to...
You were by the FASB.
FASB at the time. They were in Stanford. And I literally went over to the building where their printer presses were and grabbed like the first, I don't know what it was, half dozen or 10 copies or whatever, immediately got on the train and took the train into Midtown where my offices were and then had the courier pick them up and take them down to Wall Street. And I remember shortly after lunch then getting a call from the Goldman partner just chewing me out, something fearsome, just, you know, eating me alive. And I'm like, how can this be? I, you know, did all this for you, and now you're mad. Well, as it turned out, the Courier had dropped those new standards publications on the partner's secretary's desk, and she had not given them to the partner. And the partner wanted, at Goldman, wanted to be the very first one doing these type of off-balance sheet transactions that were all of a sudden permitted. And the fact that they'd sat on his secretary's desk for an hour or two without her giving him, he was just irate and thought I should have personally taken it down to his office and put it in his hand. I mean, it was that type of culture that you had on Wall Street, and quite frankly, it's even gotten worse since then, in terms of their desire to take advantage of whatever they can to structure these transactions, because in their mind, it is fees. You know, it's for someone like Goldman, and I don't mean to, they just happen to be the outfit here, I was working with all of them, they could do something that their clients would like, in this case, being able to take things off balance sheet, reduce capital requirements, hide leverage and debt from people, and at the same time, they're going to collect big fees for it, so it's the best of all worlds from their perspective. And you have such a culture like that. And even to this day, you've got the same thing. I was just on a panel in Denver last Friday speaking. And, of course, we have the new FASB standard out on off-balance sheet, although it's still leaving a lot off-balance sheet. If you look at, like, Citigroup and all, there's more still off the balance sheet than by a long shot than there is on the balance sheet, okay? And the deputy chief accountant, Paul Beswick, was on the panel with me, and Paul told the audience that already they're aware of three transactions that Wall Street is doing to go around these rules, and named all three transactions.
Yeah, because the way the model works now is if you're able to have decision making with one party, and that party doesn't have significant economic interests in the entity, then there's a possibility that no one will have to consolidate it. So it's kind of another phase of what we went through with FIN46R is that the standard came out. And then Wall Street, right behind it, figures out how to get around it.
Wow. And what's amazing about this, Tom, is the original standard that we had in the profession, which was done by the AICPA as opposed to the FASB, that original standard actually worked and did require these all to be on balance sheet. And then in the early 80s, had to be around 84 is my guess when FAS 77 came out, it all of a sudden let the horse out of the barn and undid what was a pretty good rule that was kind of, you know, enough principle that you could, as a regulator, really enforced it. Now we've gone through, and I've watched all these, obviously, Statement 77 when I was in the National Office of Cooper, Statement 125 that came out late 90s. It wasn't out a year when they decided they had to redo it. Statement 125, that's 125. Then Statement 140 when I was chief accountant, and then FIN 46R. I was actually there at the time they did the 3% rule and was actively involved in that one.
When the 3% rule just came through in EITF, and it was, wasn't it narrowly scoped?
The EITF.
But then it was more broadly applied, or maybe I'm mixing it up.
It's just the opposite. It was intended to be broader, okay? And the rule itself, the EITF consensus, actually has no 3% in it. It just said, if here's what you do, you put it on the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. And one of the things it said is, if you don't have enough capital in this thing, you'll have to put it on the balance sheet. So then the accounting firms immediately after that got done called up to us at the staff. I remember the phone call very vividly. It was a partner from Cooper's. It was a partner from Arthur Anderson. There were like about four of the partners on the line. And they said, well, what are you at the SEC going to accept? And as I recall, I was on the line, Bob Bayless from Corp Fin was on the line, there was a number of us, and we said, well, what do you got in mind? What are you guys saying? Because we think it ought to be real substantive capital. And they said, well, we're thinking 3%. And we said, whoa, wait a second here. And our answer, we actually put the answer in writing. And what we said in writing is, well, you guys may think it's 3%. We actually think it ought to be the typical amount of capital that you would see in a business operating in that line of business, mm-hmm. and that's what you should have. And unfortunately, the firms never enforced that. Hmm. The firm started letting them put in less than 3%. This would have been in about March of 1991. When I went back to the commission, in fact, as I was leaving the commission in 01, we got a letter from Goldman Sachs. And typically, no one disclosed these to the SEC, so the SEC wouldn't be able to go find them. There'd be nothing in, and it was off balance sheet, so there's no way you'd, right. you'd know it was there.
Because at the time, the stuff wasn't disclosed like it is now.
Correct.
Right. So and now so, there's pretty robust disclosure about the off balance sheet stuff, but it's been a progress to get there.
Not enough. not enough to really tell you what's going to happen with liquidity. Which is why there's legislation now being drafted that, and there is legislation going in Chairman Dodd's markup amendment that will require disclosure of liquidity. Last I've seen,
that's good.
One of the other senators working with him on it, but it doesn't solve the basic problem of you need to get it on balance sheet. Mm-hmm. People just don't pay attention to it unless it's really right on the balance sheet, mm-hmm. And you really can't assess leverage, liquidity. And debt, unless it's there in capital requirements as well. Mm-hmm. So, but at any rate, in 2001, Goldman had sent us in a letter, and in the letter they had identified to us that they were doing a transaction that was actually less than 3%. They were proposing less than 3%. Mm-hmm. And I remember we sent them back a letter that was... pretty straightforward and said, not only don't we think what you're doing is right, let us comment on the 3%. We don't even buy the 3% at mm-hmm. all. Mm-hmm. And went back to, you're supposed to have capital in here. But the problem was the accounting firms, auditing firms, would never enforce it. Mm-hmm. And that was a real problem. And in fact, leading up to the ITF issue, the problem was the SEC staff starting in the mid-80s, shortly after this rule was, new FASB rule in effect, and Goldman had it and was working on it, all of a sudden people started doing these things that no one could find. Mm-hmm. And there were some in the profession, led by Walter Schutz, who was head of the national office at KPMG, that said it was ridiculous. Well, KPMG was the auditor for Citigroup, and they were trying to hold the line, and Walter mm-hmm. was getting just beat to bejesus by his client at Citigroup for saying you can't do these, mm-hmm. when Coopers and Lybrand was off telling Merrill Lynch and others the world they could, and Citigroup was saying, why am I being disadvantaged? Mm-hmm. So finally, in June of 1990, Walter Schutz, this lead partner of KPMG, wrote a letter to the then chief accountant at the SEC and said, either you guys come out with something rulemaking-wise and fix this thing, or we're going to let our client do it, and you should know we're going to let them do it. It'll be your fault. I mean, it was mm-hmm. very clear. Mm-hmm. To which the SEC chief accountant then went to the FASB and said, we'd like you to do something about it. And they said, no, we don't want to do anything about it. And so we said, well, at least can you get this emerging issues task force to discuss it, which they did. And in the initial meeting, they actually voted to let it all stay off balance sheet. And then the SEC chief accountant made a plea for them to change their vote, which they finally did and then discussed, but eventually could only get them to what, in essence, became the 3% thing. And the problem was everyone knew this stuff was all going off balance sheet, and the FASB wouldn't even come to grips with it. Mm-hmm. You know, later on in about 98, they do FAS 125. That's a disaster before it's even off the printer press. And then they do FAS 140. And on FAS 140, Ed Jenkins called me the Monday of Thanksgiving in November of 1999. And Jenkins said, we're going to issue Statement 140 this week. And we were surprised. Everyone was surprised. We called around to some other auditing firms. No one knew what was coming out. So I actually called Ed back and said, we're going to object to you guys issuing it, which is something the SEC, as Jane would know, you just typically don't do. But we said, this is still so bad. And it was horrendous. Mm-hmm. And we eventually wrote them about a 6-page letter to the FASB identifying mm-hmm. all the shortcomings in FAS 140. And the other auditing firms also, led really by a partner out, Arthur Anderson, John Stewart, had told them just how bad the standard was going to be. And it got better. Obviously, didn't get good enough. And they finally put it out about 6 months, 9 months later after that event. And it's a basic fundamental problem with the way the FASB goes about doing standards and what their mission is. And their problem is, right now, their mission is, in essence, in the way they think, more importantly, you've seen this at the state, they think that they serve the management teams, they serve the investors, and they serve the auditors. And the bottom line is, you can't serve all of those three. And when you try to serve particular groups, you end up with the standard that certainly doesn't serve the capital markets and investors, because it doesn't give you the transparency and the information we've seen, which certainly contributed, it wasn't the cause of, but certainly contributed to the financial crisis.
So you end up with overly negotiated?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I use that term loosely, but we know overly negotiated standards that, you know, they might have started out with a mission that was noble to solve a certain problem, but then because they're trying to serve these different audiences and they all have different missions, in order to get a standard everybody will vote for.
Realistically, to serve the capital markets, they got to serve and give the information that people putting money into those markets, the people who make the allocation decisions as to where you're going to allocate capital, you know, the institutions like I serve on the board, the CalPERS, the CAFSTRS, those standards have to give us the information we need to make informed decisions. And for the markets to work competitively and efficiently, they have to give us the best information, and preferably they give us better information in this capital market than what we could get if we were to go into the London market or the Frankfurt market or the TSX up in Toronto. Because you really make your allocation based on two things. You know, are the companies going to be growing such that you can get the growth and the run-up in the stock market that comes with that? And are you getting the best information so you can pick which of those are the best place to put it? So it's really those two factors. If we just give people the same information you can get in any other market, then it's down to just a matter of which market, which economy is growing faster, and these days we lose that battle very quickly to some other portions of the world, you know, Brazil, Canada, Asia. You know, we're doing better in Europe these days, but that comes and goes. So it's very important we get this information. Well, the FASB, because of this trying to please everyone, we just don't get that information. And over my 3.5 decades in the business, we have seen one snafu like this after the other, and we just don't seem to be able to get the data at them. And this off-balance sheet is a prime example. When you think we had original standard that was good, then they ended it with 77, 125, FAS 140, now 166, 167. Mm-hmm. You had FIN 46, FIN 46R. You know, it's just they can't get it right. Huh. It's just, you know, it shouldn't take you what has turned into at least a half a dozen. You know, it's not even three swings at the ball here. It's like a half dozen swings at the ball, and we absolutely can't get it right. Mm. And I doubt that there's really that much disagreement amongst people about what we're trying to accomplish here, but they cannot transform that into a standard. And when they wrote the one after Enron, you know, and CalPERS had a lot of issues involved with the JEDI and the other off-balance sheet at Enron, they came out with FIN 46, this interpretation that says, okay, put this stuff on balance sheet. And people had told them it wasn't going to work, and it wasn't enough.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it came out within a year. They took it back up again within a year.
Yeah, so it was like a revision within 6 months because there were fatal flaws in the original one that was issued.
And it was so poorly written. And having been a CFO, I got to tell you, it was mind-numbing to read. It was just horrendous to read. And CFOs who I thought were tremendous, very sharp people, could not make heads or tails of it. It was so poorly written, and so almost no sooner did it come out than they started going back into FIN 46. And then when FIN 46R comes out around 203, 204, then within 2 years, they know it's not working. And so the FASB actually has an open public meeting, I'm going to say in 2006, to discuss the fact that FIN 46R still isn't working and still hasn't gotten stuff on the balance sheet. And they do a vote as to whether, okay, let's go back and do it again. And they vote 3-2 not to do it. So despite the fact people knew what was going on, things like what we saw at State Street and Citicorp, everyone knew it. I mean, I was I was running a financial research firm, and we all knew about it. We all knew what type of deals were being done off balance sheet. And that got brought to the board's attention, and yet they voted by a 3-2 vote not to do it. And one of the problems is you've got only one person from the investor side of the house on that board. One out of five.
Now, how was it before they went from 7 to 5 board members? Was there still only one there?
There was still only
one. Still only one out of seven.
There's only ever been one. Yeah. And it just doesn't work. What led to the FASB was the fact you had a predecessor group that was composed of about 15 people that did it part-time. It was usually the heads of each of the national offices of what was then the Big Eight. We still had eight at that point in time, and some academics, and throw in a couple CFOs or controllers, and that's how you get to the 15th. But the auditing firms always had control of it, and they always had a majority of the people. And this all came out of out of the accounting and auditing profession, and so the big firms always thought this was their turf, and it was only them who should write these rules. And there was such uproar about some of the poor job they'd done in the late 60s, especially then as we got into the bear market 72.
Right.
And even leading before that, there was such controversy in congressional hearings that people said, okay, we got to undo the old one, form the new one. But when they formed the new one, the auditing firms, in order to go along with it, still wanted to maintain control. So they still ended up with like three of the seven, and they've always been the chairman. The chairman of the FASB has always been one of the partners from the national offices of one of the accounting firms. And I've been in those national offices, and there's just a different perspective that they have on the issue versus mm-hmm. someone who's actually doing the investment allocation and actually doing the investing. And until we switch to really writing those standards for that group, we might get this problem fixed. We'll just keep having hiccups like this. Mm-hmm. And we've got 8 decades of accountants writing these standards, and we got, in a lot of those 8 decades, just major hiccups and mm-hmm. and blow-ups, and they just keep coming, and we don't seem to be able to get it right. So I think that's one thing that fundamentally has to change here if people are really going to fix it. And there's a very good letter that the Capital Group wrote. They're down out of L.A.
Sure, yeah.
Their vice chairman wrote an excellent letter to the chairman of the trustees of the FASB here recently, mm-hmm. just highlighting how over the years the FASB just hasn't gotten the job done.
Right.
And they are the largest active asset manager in the United States. Got about $1 trillion under active management.
Wow.
Yeah. So, there's a big difference between that and indexing. Indexing, it doesn't matter because you just go with the index. But for mm-hmm. someone like Capital, getting this information is extremely critical. Mm-hmm. So they did recently write a letter to the FASB and said this just isn't working, and did an excellent job of laying out example after example of how it hasn't worked. So you may want to.
Yeah,
I can see if I still got that letter at home.
But you'd made some observations of the 166, 167. I don't think in our hearings, but in other hearings up on the Hill for either financial services or other committees, people have alluded to the fact that 166, 167 solves all this. Everybody's concerned with off-balance sheet stuff.
Yeah, you look at Citigroup. I think they bring on about 150, 160 billion of what was 800-900 billion.
Yeah,
so the amount that's coming
still
in,
off balance.
And then you hear the deputy chief accountant talking about how people are immediately going around it. We've got nothing has changed. Absolutely, a little more comes on, but a little more now. More will now go off mm-hmm. because people are going right around it. And the fact that you've already got 3 transactions before the bodies have even turned cold, that Wall Street is out there moving. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, this is unbelievable. You know, the system isn't working. It just, something's wrong with the system when we're right back to where we were mm-hmm. in 2006. Nothing has changed from now to 2006.
Lynn, what was the number before 77?
Oh, it was just an issues paper?
Yeah, it's an issues paper.
It's another type of standard.
Do you have it?
I use that term loosely. I don't know if I do. I could backtrack it.
Why don't you look? If you can't get it, I think I've got it at home.
Yeah, since that seemed to be the starting point where this started to go bad,
right,
it'd be good to see that.
Yeah. And it's actually, I think it's referenced in the background to Statement 77, too.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's referenced there, but I think I actually have the issues paper at home.
I'm sure I don't have a hard copy of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I can get one and maybe drop it in the mail then to you.
Yeah, that'd be great if you could.
The other thing, Tom, that this feels all too familiar with from an accounting financial reporting perspective is the area of loans. Maybe we've talked about some of this in the past, but I've lived through the S&L crisis. If I've audited one, I've probably audited 50 banks.
Yeah.
Been partner on small community banks, credit unions, and big banks like Bank One. Yeah. So the whole spectrum. In fact, started my career in the office I did because we had one big bank and a bunch of smaller banks that we did. And when we got into the S&L crisis, which was principally Arizona, Texas, and Colorado, it was concentrated there, which was a good thing because it didn't hit us nationwide and globally like this one had. But the basic fundamental problem there was that the S&Ls were making bad real estate loans, a lot of bad residential as well as a lot of bad commercial loans. Keating Savings and Loan, you know.
Sure, Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln is well known. I think even the AG out of California at the time prosecuted one that Arthur Young Partners took their license for. Yeah, over that deal, as I recall. So the problem was, and I will tell you, in the office I was in with Cooper's at the time, Denver, we audited Silverado.
Who?
Oh, yeah. It's very close to home, okay?
Yeah.
In fact, I've been asked to be the audit manager on Silverado, and because of difference of views over how big the budget should be, and the fact I was doing three other real estate banks at the time, I was saved from that disaster. But
so you thought they were giving you too many hours?
I don't know. I don't recall that being part of the conversation, you know. I do recall the budget was actually set at 1,200 hours initially. And Ernst & Young had done the audit of Silverado the year before for about $450,000. And we'd had a guy go in and offer to do it for $100,000 and 1,200 hours, yeah. And I was doing three other banks and that were smaller, and I just knew there just wasn't. If it was going to take 1,000, it was going to take 5,000 hours to do Silverado, given the type of loans that they were doing. Mm-hmm. But that was a fundamental problem. And then Lincoln Keating was doing deals with Silverado as well and others, and then you had Western Savings Loan and others in Dallas and Texas. But the fundamental problem was these people in a very hot real estate market were making loans. They were able at that point in time to get the appraisals they needed to justify making the loans, and yet there was no way those properties or the residential loans were ever going to pay off. Mm-hmm. And when that whole thing blew up, I actually went in and did some workouts on some loans. Worked on good bank, bad bank workouts. Mm-hmm. Worked on some of the S&Ls that the FDIC took over. RTC actually went in and did some of the audits and stuff involved with them, so remembered it very clearly. So when I got to the commission again as chief accountant, it was kind of an intriguing thing. Shortly before I got there in 98, the Canadian banking regulators had all come down and met with the banking regulators here as well as with the SEC, and had told those two groups of regulators here that there was a real lack of transparency around the loan losses here in the U.S. And it was causing a major problem for the five big banks up in Canada. And of course, they only got the five big banks, you know, CIBC, Dominion, all those up there. But it was causing them a real problem. And it was kind of an interesting deal, because what the Canadian bankers, bank regulators were driving their banks to do was, as the economy changed, they wanted the loan loss reserves to adjust to that. So as the economy got better and you didn't have losses, loans were paying off, should be less reserve. As things start to get bad, then you should bump up the loan loss reserve, which is, bankers have always hated, as long as I've dealt with them in three, and I remember they've hated this for the last 3.5 decades. And if you go into any banker, they believe their budget should just be a flat line like a dead man. They want their budgets to be dead because it makes it the easiest way to manage capital. And you can always plan for your capital calls and what you need for capital.
So they don't want to book loan loss reserve when things are bad.
Right.
Which is what is required by GAAP.
And then they want to shave off earnings and set away the cookie jar in good times.
Right, they want to set up a
and actually
reserve under
what had happened, if you go back and actually look at what happened during the S&L days, including the research when the SNLs cratered, the problem was that the SNLs never booked the reserves fast enough as things went south, just like what we're having today, quite frankly. And when it was interesting, because you could have a public SNL that would go for some period of time, be challenged on the street that they weren't booking enough reserve, and all of a sudden, you know, a quarter or two later, book this great big bath, boom, huge number for a reserve, and the stock price would jump just like that.
Yeah.
And the reason the stock price would jump and go up was because the street thought, okay, finally they've taken their hit, and now there's no more uncertainty. Finally, we'll at least now know what the real numbers are going to be.
Things should be better in the future.
Yes,
we've seen the bad stuff.
Lurching adjustments. This is the reason.
Yeah, it was amazing to just watch it on SNL after SNL.
Oh, interesting.
And see how the street, and their prices were being phenomenally depressed because of uncertainty over the numbers and the outcome. Just like this last time, as Citi and all these people got in trouble, all of a sudden you saw their stock go down to $2, $1, $3, you know, and become penny stocks because no one trusted the numbers anymore. And then now as things have started to clarify up, people started to get a little bit better hand. Now you're seeing the price come back. It is deja vu, SNLs all over again, just the exact same thing. The thing that we never got accomplished, well, the SEC and the banking regulators, while I was there, had a big nasty fight over this whole issue on loan loss reserves. And so we agreed as a group that we'd ask the accounting standard setters to take up a project, and they did at the end of 98, first part of 99, to go do a new standard on accounting for loan losses, and even more importantly, give us really good disclosure around it. Because if you could get by each major category of loans, ag loans, commercial real estate, you know, commercial construction, real estate construction, the various categories that the banks each have. If you could get those loans broken down by the principal amount that was all current, 30 days past due, 60, 90, 180, and non-performing, and then get some notion as to whether any of that's geographically centralized to, you know, the southeast or the southwest, California, the north, then you could really start to get a flavor for whether or not the bank you were investing in was going to be okay. And furthermore, from a regulatory perspective, whether or not you had enough capital there to allow them to make it through a really tough time. And we had a terrible fight over a bank. Before I got there, a week before I got there, the staff had sent out 25 letters to the 25 biggest banks in the country and challenged them on their loan loss reserves. And in fact, we found a number were doing it okay, but a number actually came back in and admitted they'd done them wrong. And the worst problem was with SunTrust. SunTrust had this great big unknown, a great big cookie jar, much bigger than any of the losses they would have. I mean, they had actually managed the bank phenomenally well, and their loans were in, at that point in time, in part of the southeast that was just hitting on all cylinders and doing phenomenal. And yet, they had built up this great big reserve during the SNL crisis and no longer needed it. So they were actually significantly understating their profits to investors. So if you're an investor in SunTrust, the stock price actually should have been higher, and you should have been able to sell your stock for more money. And they weren't telling people. It's kind of a nuance, but what they wanted to do was save that until they got into a really bad time like now, and then they'd run it off, and it wouldn't look like they'd gotten into any trouble then. Well, the problem that creates then is when you're getting in trouble, it's SNLs all over again. You never know that you're in trouble till it's too late. because they're using those reserves to run off the losses that are really popping up in the portfolio. And in during this crisis, a lot of people have said, well, the rules didn't allow us to book our loan losses fast enough, which should be a concern to everyone if that was the case. But public data shows that by mid-2006, many of these loans were going bad the moment they were done. The no-doc, the liar loans, the stated income loans.
Right.
You know, they were bad, and a high percentage were bad the moment the loan went out the door. And the accounting rules that the SEC and the banking regulators all agreed to, it's Staff Accounting Bulletin 102, all say that if you've got that type of data, you've got to start increasing your reserves. And yet we never saw any change in reserves. And what's phenomenal about it is I was doing an investigation over at Freddie at the time and working with Lockhart and that crew over there.
Right, right.
And so they're showing us data that shows that starting in the first quarter of 2007, Countrywide, WaMu, Wachovia, Citigroup, the major market makers here, you know, brokers, are starting to pull out of the business because they're starting to see these losses come in. And in fact, whereas they're probably about 70-75% of the real estate mortgage market at the end of the first quarter of 07, by the time you get to 9/30 of 07, they're less than a third. And Fannie and Freddie, the administration, Treasury, and the White House, had to go in and bring Fannie and Freddie in to pick up, start making, either making, buying, or guaranteeing all those loans, or the mortgage market would collapse on them.
Sure.
And so the banks themselves are sitting there, in essence, getting out of it because they know it's going bad. And actually, there's an SEC complaint against Mozilla and the people at Countrywide that has some great descriptions of how Mozilla is out talking to people and they're telling you these loans are all going bad and all. And yet at the end of the day, you don't see the reserves go up. And the accounting rules clearly say that going back to about the second quarter of 2006, the loan loss reserves should have been going up. And the reason the market couldn't bring discipline to it and force them to do it is it didn't have those disclosures. And that project that the SEC and
bank... You'd only know that if you had the internal data that the firms had, because it wasn't being disclosed voluntarily, and it wasn't required to be disclosed.
And when the SEC and the banking regulators got into this battle, one of the things that we did to work it out amongst ourselves was we all agreed to set up what became known as the Shipley Commission. Walter Shipley, former chairman of Chase, well known, you know, widely respected.
Right.
So a committee of about 10 gets set up, and it's got senior executives. It's got Walter Shipley as the chair. It's got senior executives from Citigroup, HSBC, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, every one of these guys that all had to have bailout money. And they
issued... It's the tarp list. I mean,
it's the entire tarp list, Tom! They put out a report. They put out a report in January of 01, I think it is. And it's a great report. And it turns around and says, there has to be more disclosure. There has to be much better disclosure of risks. There has to be much better disclosure of the risks that we're having in derivatives. There has to be disclosure of the CAMEL ratings on the loans in these banks, including the internal CAMEL ratings. And this has to be disclosed to the public.
Yeah.
And I'm in meetings with Greenspan at the time. And Greenspan says, well, we will not do it rulemaking-wise. We'll let them do it voluntarily. And it's like, you got to be kidding me. These banks, I've lived with them. There has never been a banker that voluntarily made a disclosure in their life, you know?
Right, right.
you know?
Well, largely it's the competitive disadvantage thing that you talked about with the off-balance sheet stuff. So if one party voluntarily decides to disclose something and the other parties aren't disclosing it, potentially there's a competitive disadvantage to it providing additional information about risks. Become the disclosure.
Well, especially if you were a bank that were making lousy loans and getting in trouble and going to need capital.
Yeah. If everything's rosy, you'd be happy to voluntarily disclose
that. But I remember Greenspan, I might have mentioned this to you, Greenspan and was in a meeting with me and Levitt, Harvey Goldsmith, all the banking regulators. In fact, we were in the FDIC. No, we were over at the Fed building at the time, I forget, in Greenspan's conference room. And Greenspan, we're talking about all these issues, and Greenspan kicks off the meeting, and I mean, within just a few minutes into the meeting, he finally turns to me and says, Lynn, what is the problem if we let these banks fudge their numbers a little bit? That is a quote. That is a quote.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, we just never got the transparency. Mm-hmm. And then the Shipley thing totally got dropped and not acted on. And, in fact, that effort by the accountants to improve the disclosures got killed by the banking regulators. It was...
Because we have a long-standing disagreement between banking regulators.
Oh,
and
it's the whole transparency issue. They don't
all
like
about
transparency, and they hate it. They hate it.
And fair value, and for this, in this case,
wow, your
loan five model for loan loss.
The problem it creates,
that's contrary to what the banking regulators think.
The banking regulators have always been concerned that if the public saw data that said a bank was really bad, there'd be a run on the bank, which is stupid. It's the dumbest thing, and it's an absolute horrendous. It's just wrong, because if you have that disclosure out there, you'll never get to the run on the bank, because people, there'll be such market discipline brought to the bank that people early on will start pulling out, so you never get to the run, and then the management and board have to react. It's only that you get to a run when everything is held, and then all of a sudden everyone gets nervous, and you have Lehman, Bear, Merrill, you do have a run on the bank when you don't have transparency. So what the Fed brings us is exactly what they say they're trying to avoid. They bring us the run on the banks. If we had the transparency. And what's a shame about it is there's been a good report by the GAO, and there's been an excellent report by the Inspector General of the FDIC. And it's become an issue out in Colorado, because the largest bank ever in the history that Colorado failed during this bank called New Frontier. Mm-hmm. And the Inspector General went in and looked at it, and what he found was that the key banking regulator, in this case it was state charter, so it was the FDIC at the federal level, so it was the FDIC that had their people in. The FDIC started issuing reports in 2004 saying the bank was in trouble. And by 2008, I believe it is, they actually come out and in their own internal reports, examination reports, they turn around and say, quote, their language, not mine, it is highly likely that this bank will fail. At the same time that bank is included on the list of well-capitalized banks coming out of the FDIC to the public. And that caused a lot of damage. It did phenomenal damage to our economy in Colorado, because that bank was making a lot of the ag loans, and they failed, and we've had a lot of the ag community really struggle now to get financing. Those internal reports coming out of the federal banking examiners, I've seen them because I've been an auditor.
Okay.
And as an auditor, at times you can pry them out of the feds and get them and see what's in there. There's nothing in there that I think would ever cause a run on a bank. What is in there are things that literally say, here's what the bank's got to improve on. And the banks hate seeing that go public. And let's be real, 17,000 of the 20,000 employees at the Fed are at the regional banks. And at the regional banks, the directors are, you know, a third of them come straight out of the bankers. A third of them are picked by the Fed here. Mm-hmm. And there's another third that are, in essence, then picked by those people. So it's the banks themselves run their Federal Reserve. That's the way it was set up.
That was the structure. That's why they have boards.
Yeah, and it was a big political fight. In fact, when the Fed was originally passed, the legislation was passed, it was only passed with 40-some votes in the Senate. Didn't even have a majority of the votes of the Senate. It was very highly contentious, but that was the workout. Mm-hmm. But the reality people have to understand is who's running the Fed banks, and that's where 17 to 20,000 employees are. And so there's some natural human tendency just not to go say if things are really bad. But the fact we don't get that transparency out there, and we don't get the stuff like mm-hmm. the Shipley Committee out there, means the markets can't discipline themselves. If we get the markets out there, then I, as an investor, can move my capital around
sure.
and decide who the winners and losers are, which will force those losers to change.
Yeah.
But if I can't get that information out, then the system can't work, which is exactly what we had happen.
What about that fair value accounting? Because a lot of people argue that fair value accounting, they argue both sides of it, which is kind of the similar arguments to loan loss reserving, right?
Well, first
some people believe fair value accounting is a problem. We should suspend it. We shouldn't have it. And accountants are more
An argument for eight decades, and the bankers have always just absolutely despised and hated fair value accounting. Again, it's because they want their earnings to be flatline, like a dead man.
Right, sure.
Because that allows you to manage. It doesn't cause you any problems with managing capital, and that's what they always shoot for. In fact, it used to be, if you go back to the way the accounting for banks was done, mm-hmm. going back to probably the middle of almost to the end of the 60s, the way the banks would do accounting is they would literally set their budget for the year, mm-hmm. divide by 12, and that'd be your financials for, you know, until the end of the year. I mean, everything was driven.
Amazing.
Everything was, and so when the accountants started to finally say towards, you know, as we got out of the 50s and the end of the 60s, no, you really got to do this accounting. I mm-hmm. mean, the banks and the accountants have been at war ever since. They've hated, they just don't like it. In fact, I had a meeting when I was chief accountant here with a committee that's from the ICPA that's composed of the bankers and the auditors of banks, and we're having problems with how they're accounting for some of these derivatives, big problems inside banks, including inside the ones like Citigroup. So I called them all in one day, and I said, this is probably about January of 1999, I said, look, there's this problem. It seems to me it's black and white. You guys aren't following the rules.
Right, right.
And you know, can someone explain that to me? And one of the people who I came in was the partner on J.P. Morgan, who was a friend of mine. He was at PricewaterhouseCoopers, my former firm. And when I teed this question up, very simple like that, there was silence. And I just sat there and waited for someone to ask. It was like a minute. Yeah. And then finally this Woody Wallace, who was a friend, he said, Lynn, you know that there isn't an accountant in this room that is going to challenge a single one of these big banks on this unless you hold our feet to the fire. Mm-hmm. And the big banks and the big investment banks on Wall Street had such that, and again, I worked down there on Wall Street with them, mm-hmm. worked mm-hmm. on Goldman, who was a major client of ours at Cooper's, and they just have such a pull on them. Culture is such, and the money is such, they have a very difficult time. And so we've all seen the Veloukis report on repo 105s. Mm-hmm. Am I surprised that ENY found a way to justify that accounting? Not at all. I'd almost probably find it more surprising if they had stood up and said no. Mm. It just isn't the way it operates. It's very much, and you've seen some of this in some of your hearings, I've watched some of them, mm-hmm. it's very much a cultural issue on the Wall Street. It's why you see all the debate going on over the fiduciary standard. You know, God forbid if they actually had act as a fiduciary on some of these transactions. That would be a cultural shock for them. And that's why I don't think Spector's legislation will even be introduced. But Spector's legislation, which says not only do you have to be a fiduciary, but we're going to add criminality to it. Mm-hmm. He's got a 30-year prosecutor working with him on drafting it. And the fact that they'd have criminality attached to fiduciary, that one piece of legislation more than anything would probably change things. Absolutely. It would just the thought of people going to jail would be a new event. New event. So
fair value.
Oh, fair value.
Fair value is reflected certainly on the face of the balance sheets of these institutions.
First of all, by far and away, the biggest asset on a bank is the loans. Ultimately, you either make or lose money based upon loans. You either make sound loans and do very well, or you make lousy loans and do very bad. The other things are almost, unless you get into something like AIG did with the derivatives, and there's limits on what banks can do. I mean, and the Fed is careful about that to some extent. But the loans is it. And loans aren't fair value. And that's why when the Federal Reserve, Boston Bank, issued a report earlier this year, it was January or March right in there this year, they studied this issue.
Right.
And I think of all people, my experience has always been the Fed doesn't like fair value. In fact, I've met with the economist at the Fed and asked him about all the fair values in the footnotes and don't they use all the data and all. And they will tell you no. And the reason is they've got no comfort that management is giving them good numbers. They think that there's so much softness in those numbers, and they're so subjective to manipulation that the Fed just doesn't trust them.
Manipulation up or down.
Exactly. They really hate them when they go up. They really hate them when they go up, because when they go up, they create capital. And if they've been manipulated up, and that's happened with them on some of the banks that have failed, so I understand why they're coming, where they're coming from. But the problem isn't the fair value. It's the fact that you aren't doing what you need to do to get to fair value. And in fact, before I left the commission in the spring of 2001, I actually wrote a letter to the FASB and the AICPA as chief accountant. Jan, I think it may still be out on the website, that turns around and says, looky, you know, this is 10 years ago. I said, we're starting to use fair value a whole lot more than what we've done in the past. And it's a good thing. I investors inevitably will tell you they got to have that number.
Right.
But I turned around and said, okay, since we're going to be using it a lot more, and I sympathize with the Fed. This was right after I'd met with the Fed and met with their economist. I said, I sympathize with the people that are concerned about it. So let's put together the groups here at the FASB or the AICPA or in industry, and let's go out and create some guidance on how to do this so that we get numbers we can all have faith in and trust. It's not that we don't need the numbers. We need the numbers. But we also need numbers that we can all trust.
So valuation standards?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is one of the criticisms pre-157 is even if we issue 157, I mean, it's one of the public criticisms that I'm aware of, but even with 157, there's not really, you know, standards of professional practice for valuation experts.
Yeah.
Like there are for accountants and other professionals.
No. And unfortunately, no one ever acted on that request. Yeah. And I left shortly after the letter, so it was unfortunate, but because now as we got into all this use of fair value for, like, the residuals that they hold in the asset-backed securities, banks all harp, well, we're never going to have these losses. And at the time, I was actually doing a project over at the Federal Home Loan Banks, which is this largest debtor in this country outside of the government itself. They borrow $1.5 trillion or something.
Right.
And they were having this same problem. And in fact, they went, they're the ones that went and lobbied Congress really hard, Kanjorski and Frank, to give the banks all a break on fair value. And that was because the Federal Home Loan Bank in Seattle, Boston, San Francisco, and Atlanta were in dire straits. Those banks had been making the loans to the Countrywides and the WAMUs to keep them afloat. And they had also bought a bunch of their asset-backed security paper that was horrendous. Right. And in fact, the Federal Home Loan Bank of Seattle, I think it is, actually went and testified before Kanjorski and said, PricewaterhouseCoopers is telling us we're going to have to take this great big loss. And I think their testimony said that they ultimately end up with just a $14 million loss rather than the billion, hundreds of millions, billion. And in fact, I happen to know they were having a big fight with PricewaterhouseCoopers because Coopers was fighting with them, and it was a lot of it was over what method and how do you value this stuff. Well, as it turns out, the FLUB of Seattle has now sued the people who sold them that paper, the banks and other, for $3 billion of losses.
Wow.
Compared to what that bank president told Kanjorski, his loss would be only $14 million. It was a joke. And I was in with the bank presidents. I got to tell you, they were lying to Congress through their... And in fact, the chairman of the audit committee at the FLUB resigned over it all, and that's Chuck Bowser, who used to be the comptroller to the U.S.
Oh, yeah, very distinguished person.
Absolutely spectacular. And Chuck was the one that brought me into the FLUB to look at this. And he was nervous about it. When I got in and looked at it, it was like, oh, this is not good. And so, you know, but I was in the meeting with the bank president trying to tell Chuck it's only a $14 million loss. I mean, it was, you had to be nuts to think it was, and they just didn't want to go out and tell people. And quite frankly, their regulator, who's the same regulator for Fannie and Freddie, didn't want to press them to go get the capital. And it's like, guys... So, but the fair value, most of what's on the balance sheet of the bank and where the losses really were was not where things were fair valued. It was the loans. They had losses to the extent that they kept a residual in the loans. And when you securitize these loans, the way you do it to make it work for the people buying into the pools of loans, you have to keep so much back as a residual. So, you know, the law now requires you, the new law will require them to keep like 5%. Oh, they're already doing that. That new law has no impact whatsoever.
Did I tell you this already? No, I've been lobbying. I've been talking this up because the retention in and of itself, they're already retaining some. The
you
smart
have to
guys
the
hedge it if they want to.
Yeah.
And the people that don't hedge it sometimes get caught. Right?
Which is what they did.
Yeah. But the original draft legislation seems as though it was trying to preclude hedging. But it's not clear to me how that would ever be workable, because I don't know as though, you know, okay, you can't hedge that specific retained interest, but you can put on a hedge that hedges the same risk.
You know,
you can enter into something else that hedges it.
It's interesting, because any smart businessman would want to hedge that risk, you know.
So retaining, 5%.
And if I do a loan, realistically, if I do a loan to someone today, I can hedge that. I can get insurance because I can go buy some type of
you can do
protection from a hedge fund or something on those loans. So that I can do anyway. The legislation telling people keep 5% on, that's ridiculous. That's why they had the losses they did. They kept the 5%. And the way you set up the pool, when you sell this pool of loans into the trust, it's required that you keep some interest in it. The investors want you to keep some interest in it. And the holdback is that as the cash comes in to pay these people off, that 5% that should go to you, there's a trigger. And if they aren't getting enough, there's a trigger in every one of these deals, and it says if they aren't getting enough, pay them off in full, then all of a sudden they get your share.
Right.
And that's why they force everyone into keeping that 5% or so, because it serves as an over-collateralization, mm-hmm. in essence, for the whole pool. So all of these deals had that built into it, and that was the piece that got people in trouble. And unfortunately, despite the urging of the accounting profession to come up with valuation for that, mm-hmm. they didn't, and didn't come out with really strict guidelines that would have dealt with the Fed's concern that these are squishy mm-hmm. numbers. And the Fed was most concerned when banks would write those numbers up. And in fact, the rules did allow them to write those residuals up as well as down. And so in good times, people were taking gains on those and writing them up, and the Fed was sitting there going, is this really real?
Right.
And
so if it was a rated residual or a modelable residual, they would account for my fair value. But yeah. Some of the, like if it was an equity tranche that they retained, they're not, that tranche is not rated. So I thought in some cases that if they retained the equity tranche, they would carry that as a cost-based investment. So we've heard criticisms that sometimes they if they retain the equity interest, this is back to the, mm-hmm. right, if they book it at cost, and at some point in time these structures are crumbling and they didn't write down their cost-based investment.
Yeah, I'm not sure an equity would have qualified for a cost-based. I think I'd have to go back and look at that. A bond,
so
if you had a debt, if you had a debt,
piece of the debt
that was
right?
held that was held to maturity, then you could have kept it at cost. If you'd had the equity component, it would have been marked to market. Mm-hmm. So in fact, as things got bad, a bunch of them who had the debt component of it were moving from the held for sale into held to maturity, because if you held it for sale, you had to take the market.
Right.
If you held to maturity, you didn't. And the bottom line was, no one held this stuff to maturity. No one could hold a mortgage loan for the 30 years to maturity. And in fact, we all know that they were getting paid off on average in about 11 years. So there's no way for you to hold them to maturity. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't up to you. It was the homeowners.
Right.
And so when the average homeowner pays off because of all the moving around and changing homes, it was a figment of someone's imagination. But it certainly wasn't the mark-to-market that caused the problem. It was the fact that the payments weren't coming in on the loans to start with, and the loans mm-hmm. were going bad. Exactly like what happened in the SNL days. And mm-hmm. in fact, there, if you go back to coming out of the SNL days, there's an excellent GAO report or two about the fact that the banks didn't take their losses and their write-downs, either on the mark-to-market or on the loans, fast enough during the SNL days, mm-hmm. as we talked about a while back, and that drove up the cost of the SNL bailout substantially. And Bowser was the comptroller and head of the GAO at the time, and that's what they concluded. They actually went and studied it for Congress, and the conclusion was... Mm-hmm.
I think the cost being excessive is also in that. There's an overall like FDIC study of the past crises, including the SNL crisis. I think it's in that, which is a kind of comprehensive.
The bottom line is if you know as a manager, you're going to have to take that loss or write down, mm-hmm. then you react to it.
Sure.
You manage it much closer because you know you're going to get in trouble. Your board's going to chew mm-hmm. you out, mm-hmm. your investors, stockholders. And no one likes a loss. What's worse is when you have a loss with the surprise. So if you force everyone to keep that out publicly, then management teams will tend to manage it. What had happened in the SNL, which now transpired again with these banks, mm-hmm. is people didn't know about it, therefore people ignored it, didn't manage it,
right.
And we just, in fact, in the Countrywide case, again, back to the SEC complaint against Mazzella, they sit there and they talk about how they continue to make these payday, not payday, but pay option arms. Mm-hmm. and they just keep doing it. They know that there's a problem, but they just keep doing it because everyone's doing it, and no one's being required to become transparent and record the losses on it. And as a result, Mozilla never forces his team to manage it. Mm-hmm. Never forces. He keeps going back and tells him, his chief operating officer, CFO, man, people are telling me here's the problem. And they never turn around and stop making them. They just keep going. And there's nothing that's forced out into the disclosures that say, oh, look at all these pay option arms, and here's the amount that are delinquent, and, you know, they're your brand new loans. If that disclosure had been out there, I'm convinced we wouldn't have had near the magnitude of the problem, just as if it had been out there during the SNL days.
Okay, and just specifically, you're talking about the loss reserves, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it would have been nice if on the residuals and all, we were getting the same write-downs, because ultimately, at the end of the day, someone's holding the loan and has to take the write-down on the loan, but someone's still holding this residual. At the end of the day, it's all the same thing. It's cash flows coming out of the loans. We can slice it and dice it as we do these days, like sausage. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's all money coming from a group of people who own homes, and they're either going to pay me or not, whether I hold it as a loan or hold it as a residual. Really doesn't matter. I don't care what you call it. To me, it's just, I got X amount of cash that you owe me, and are you going to pay me or not? And the bottom line was, we had such a feeding frenzy in this country, and no one wanted to stop it. We had musical chairs going on, and no one wanted to turn off the music. Because we actually, if you look at the inventory of homes being built, the units of homes being built, it was outstripping any possibility of demand. So not only did we build up this inventory and use all this cash to continue to funnel to the real estate company's building, but we knew they were building too much because it was outstripping any potential demand for people coming in. So we built ourselves an inventory, and then we started selling them to people who could never pay.
Sure.
We might as well just been taking the toilet and just by the trash can, throwing the bucks in and flushing.
Right, right.
You know, and it's the same thing happened in the Southwest. It is exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that we didn't learn much from that lesson. And if you go back and look at the balance sheet of Silverado, CDOs, CMOs,
really?
All on the balance sheet of Silverado.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And off-balance sheet transactions between Lincoln Savings and Loan and Silverado, and there's a real estate development company called Richmond Homes, Mizell Development, MDC Homes. I mean, so we had a lot of the same stuff. It was just, it wasn't of the magnitude that we've seen this time, thank goodness.
And we have different products now, different mortgage products.
Well, you do, and then you've got the AIG derivatives, which certainly you didn't have. You had some things, you know, you had guarantees, you had credit ratings at the time, but nothing in the volume like what we've had this time. The volume is just phenomenal. But when you think about the fact that already we've got Wall Street designing new products and going to market with new products to get around the rules and subvert transparency all again, I'd be willing to bet the house and double down, quite frankly, right now, that within the next 10 to 15 years we'll have the same thing all over again. The cycles just start getting shorter.
We'll have crises, but we'll have them more frequently, because we'll go through the same process.
Yeah.
It'll just happen faster. We have bigger and bigger financial institutions.
So you go from the 72-73 bear market, which had a lot to do with debt and leverage because everyone had gone out and done all the M&A transactions, the Gulf Westerns, all the transactions there. And then as the economy collapsed, they get in trouble. Same thing with Penn Central. They couldn't afford the debt they'd taken on. You go to the latter part of the 80s, you know, and then now here, latter part of this last decade, it is, you know, 15, 20 years, it's just kaboom, kaboom, kaboom. Mm-hmm. And you could put the .com in there, but that was kind of a...
So certainly,
that was just sheer lunacy. That was totally insane.
Lots of error.
Yeah.
But so if we had the things that are in off balance sheet vehicles on people's balance sheets, kind of set aside the GSE guaranteed mortgages, but all the other stuff, that would arguably slow down the process.
Yeah, people just
because it, given the sense the capital requirements we have now, that would slow down the process.
People just operate. That's just my. People just operate and react differently. It's amazing. When I was running the semiconductor company, I remember one day the senior VP of manufacturing and operations came in, and we were building a brand new fab, and we're mm-hmm. going to commercialize it, put all the big equipment in, and you know these things are billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar buildings. So we were going to finance some of it through GE with leases, because mm-hmm. GE offered us the lowest rates and all. And GE come and talked to him and said, we could take all this off balance sheet. He said, Lynn, if we do all this with all this off balance sheet stuff, then I don't have to worry about people asking me how we're going to pay it because it's not on the balance sheet. And I said, let me tell you, Tim, everything we're doing is on balance sheet. I'm going to make sure it's all on balance sheet because I never want to have to deal with a fight with you over where we're going to pay or not. And we did. Mm-hmm. We put literally everything on balance sheet, all of our leases, when we triggered
large
it.
Large capital, yeah. There's always the leasing solution, the off balance sheet, the no pay lease. Yeah.
But people just manage and react to it just over the years, I found phenomenally different. And so if you can get the leverage and get the liquidity on the balance sheet, and then get good disclosures in the footnotes about, you know, the timing of those payments and your liquidity, you're going to be okay. But if not, we'll be right back to the same thing. We'll not avoid it. There's no way we will.
People don't really look much past the primary financial statements. They just don't have, they may not have the skills and certainly not the will to go through the detailed disclosures.
Well, and certainly the sell side doesn't, because if the sell side does and it creates a problem for the management team typically cuts the sell side off in the phone calls. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden that disadvantages the sell side, and then that analyst doesn't get rated very well. There's an annual rating of all sell side analysts done in what's known as institutional investor each year. And if you want a big bonus, you had best be one of those top 3 to 5 in the rankings in your industry, because if not, you ain't going to get no bonus. So, and those rankings are done by the people in the company. So it becomes a very incestuous process.
Right.
And so certainly, unless you can put it on the balance sheet and force the sell side to have to deal with it, yeah, that ain't going to happen. And, you know, quite frankly, it is tough, even for the people at the SEC or the federal banking regulators. If you don't see it there, you just don't know it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's difficult to know what different banks and all are doing. I was shocked when State Street came out and announced that they had a number of these SIFs off. And we use State Street as a sub-advisor to our mutual fund. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have guessed in 1,000 years that State Street, given their background, that they were off putting together these pools and SIFs. Citigroup, yeah, that I could understand. But State Street, given the way they operate and what their business was, mm-hmm. I was just stunned and shocked.
It just shows you how common practice it is. It's kind of standard operating business practice.
Yeah.
But, you know, I knew Wall Street was doing it, and I knew what was going on in New York with all the off-balance sheet stuff and the companies and all. Mm-hmm. But when even a large asset manager really serves a different market is starting to get into that. I mean, it is, again, it's just a runaway train, and the train runs away because no one knows about it. No one is capable. The markets aren't capable of self-discipline. And if you can't get that information to the markets, they can't discipline. The notion that the markets are efficient is stupid. In the long run, very efficient. But in the short run, and the short run has turned to be several years now, they just absolutely aren't. Arthur and I never thought so at the SEC. And it was because of this unknown. You just don't know what the market doesn't know. And so unless you can force it out into the market can't discipline. Mm-hmm. You get it out there, the market does a pretty good job of disciplining and becomes much more efficient.
Right.
So there needs to be much better data out here on these loans without a doubt. And the FASB is doing a project to get some of it, but I think, again, like with their SPE stuff, it looks like it's going to fall short.
What about transparency on derivatives? Huge portfolios, huge notional amounts.
Let me give you my concern about the derivatives, and I don't think we've seen the real shoe fall on derivatives. And I knew AIG very well because I'd been involved with what had happened in 2004, and Leavitt was brought in to redo the governance, and I got in the middle of that fight and met with them. Chairman of the board, Zarb, a couple times, and the guy that finally said there was a problem is Joe St. Denis. I think I mentioned his name to you. I knew Joe very well. My concern is, you know, what's happened with AIG is water over the dam, but we've got $600 trillion out there in derivatives. About $400 trillion is in interest rate swaps. The total GDP for the world is only about $60-65 trillion. So the derivative market, think of it this way. Think of that picture of the whole Earth from outer space, you know?
Right.
Okay? That's this big. The derivative market is 10 times bigger. It's bigger than Jupiter and Saturn.
Yeah.
You know? So $600 trillion. So the cash flows... Fortunately, a lot of that is net settled, so you don't have to come up with the cash flows. But the fact that it's 6 or 10 times the entire world GDP, it can be settled on a net basis, and yet market movements can dwarf it. And the $400 trillion in interest rate swaps concerns me, because if we had a spike in interest rates, and I don't think we're going to, given the current condition of the world's economy, but there are clearly people, you know, I was watching the news this morning, there's clearly people that think we are going to have the run-up. And the run-up in the gold prices would tell you that some people think that it's going to happen. If we had a spike from the 0.5% interest rate we're at today to, let's say, 5%, our markets would crater. There's no way they could survive, because the amount of the payments on those interest rate swaps would, on $400 trillion in interest rate swaps, would run up so high that I think there'd be a lot of counterparties that couldn't pay them. And some of those counterparties owe that money to state and local governments, because state and local governments have done a lot of this, which is why in Blanche Lincoln's bill, there's a specific section just for public pensions and state and local governments, and the fiduciary obligation on swaps to those. And it's because they've put, like in Jefferson, Alabama, so many of these state and local governments into these things, Wall Street has, that they've become totally toxic and bankrupted that government, literally bankrupted that government. And with $400 trillion of these swaps out there, I guarantee you, if we had that movement, and, you know, a 0.5% to 5%, 4%, if we had a spike in interest, and that's not a real spike. I was around. It's nothing. That is not a spike. That's taking us back to where the interest rates typically would be.
Sure.
I can tell you, you're going to have another financial crisis, because those numbers are so big, and people say, well, it's $400 trillion notional. Yeah, but you're paying interest on 400 trillion. You're doing that calculation on the 400 trillion. You aren't paying the 400 trillion, but what's 6% on 400 trillion? You know, mm-hmm. the numbers have gotten so big.
Right.
And so on the balance sheet, we tend to net this stuff down. And what we say in the paper, what Frank Partnoy was a trader on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. Frank has actually done this stuff. He wrote the book Fiasco. He's now a law professor down at San Diego. And so Frank, in my view, is we should never allow the netting of this type of stuff. And let's make sure we get the gross obligation on both sides up on the balance sheet so everyone can see.
So still be at fair value, but be gross, not net by counterparty?
Yeah, never net. Okay. And Frank would even probably take it further than just grossing it up at fair value. He would not even fair value the liabilities. He'd say, give me the gross cash flows.
Yeah.
And that for interest rate derivatives?
And I don't know what I'd go. He'd say gross on notional, but figure the gross cash flows you have on both sides of that interest rate swap and calculate that as your liability and put that on. I don't think he'd say inflate your balance sheet to 400 trillion because that becomes a mind-numbing number.
You can just book the interest receivable and payable.
Yeah.
He's on my list to talk to.
But it would certainly be, we have got to get, at the end of the day, we got to get these balance sheets so we show the gross amount of the cash flows that are going to come in on the asset side and the gross amount of cash flows that we're going to have to pay out on the liability side so we can figure out exactly how much we got to have in capital in these institutions and whether or not we've got a safe enough capital cushion here that if either of these don't work out, you know, people are protected. And it isn't that we want to bail out. Don't want to bail. We actually want those companies to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. We want to have sustainable industry so that they can create the jobs, and we never even get to the bailout type situation. But as long as you've got these huge institutions that are clearly defined now as too big to fail, if you can't get the gross cash flows up going on both sides, it's hopeless. We'll be right back to this. You absolutely, history has shown, and we should have learned our lesson by now, that if you don't, it will not be managed and it will not be solved.
So for interest rate currency, I assume would be the same notion. We want currency swaps, the cash flows out of there.
Yep.
But then what about other types of derivatives like options and forwards and things that are actually triggered at later dates?
You know, let's take, for example, options, even a stock option or a equity option. A lot of the time that stuff today is never settled as an equity instrument. It's always cash paid off.
Right.
So like when most companies give stock options out, typically there's some arrangement to cash out of that at the end of it. In fact, all the broker-dealers, so when I was on the Sun Microsystem board, the arrangement was already set up, I think, with Solomon Smith Barney or one of the guys in at that point in time.
They'll cash that you out.
Yeah. Boom. And in fact, we did research at Glass Lewis that said something like 85% of the stock options granted in the U.S. are never issued as stock. It's cashed out. It is cashed out. Yeah, I mean, it's the notion that you're accounting for an equity instrument, you know, it's, hey, would you rather have a bird in the hand or one in the bush? And, you know, after the dot-com, a lot of people were saying, I don't want the stock. Give me the cash.
Sure, cash in the barrel.
Yeah, I remember the employees down at Intel who were all clamoring for equity before the dot-com crash, and afterwards they all wanted cash.
Cash is king.
Yeah. So, but that's just people. So, I think ultimately you got to get back to what's going to happen with cash flows. And ultimately, and that's what investors are going to look at, because ultimately something's going to get priced when the analysts really get down to pricing in the market. When the really good hedge funds, you go inside, my experience has been when you really go into the side, the hedge funds that are really able to perform, they are looking at the cash flows. They're managing to the cash flows. That's why Paulson did what he did with some of the stuff with Goldman. He knew that it was his bet, you know, not that he knew, he was placing a bet at the time, that these things just wouldn't pay off and the cash wouldn't be there. was very simple, mm-hmm. you know. And I remember back in 94 when Procter & Gamble and American Greeting Card and all those guys mm-hmm. got in trouble, right. made a shell shaft over the derivatives. And the problem there was the...
What were those, the derivatives that they had problems with? I forgot now.
There was some type of leveraged up derivative.
Yeah.
But they were leveraged. In fact, they might have been tied to some interest rate swap type stuff, but they had leverage built on them. So when the market moved, it moved exponentially real quick against them. And they didn't understand it. And what came back out of that was the P&G executives, who I'd actually known at the time, just never sat down and on a piece of paper mm-hmm. forced Bankers Trust to draw out for them. Both sides of the equation, the cash flow, and really show them how to understand.
Really understand
in fact, there were
works.
Actual tape recordings at the time of the Bankers Trust people who said that the tape recordings got them in trouble, but mm-hmm. it also became clear that they had been able to mislead the P&G people. It wasn't that they misled them as much as it was they just didn't tell them the whole truth.
Yeah.
And because P&G... people didn't ask, and even in these big companies, the people tend, you know, they don't want to, Goldman or someone comes in, and you'll see them sit there and be reluctant to ask questions where someone might say, well, you don't already know that, you know, they just don't mm-hmm. like that, and that's what happened with
P&G. They don't want to insult right. the audience that's there to present
and,
them.
And to some degree, what we saw happen at P&G is what we saw happen at AIG, because the directors on the executive committee, one of them has told me, you know, he met with management and all, but he clearly still just didn't understand, and they didn't get the info they needed to understand what had gone on there. Which is, you know, you'd think in the world's largest insurance company, at least board members on the executive committee would have got that. And this isn't a stupid person, a very sharp person, but they just didn't. I think they just didn't probe hard enough and far enough down.
So in some of these organizations, I mean, you use that as an example, but do you have a perception about kind of corporate governance, corporate culture, because it seems like you're saying some of this comes down to corporate or individual cultures when they're, you know, they're dealing with making decisions about certain transactions.
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I was just talking to one of my fellow board members on AARP Mutual Fund, and we're just having this discussion as a result of our board meeting. He had been pressing some very hard questions, really good. And this guy's former general counsel of Fidelity. He was the general counsel of Fidelity under Ned Johnson's dad.
Well, presumably he's not afraid to ask questions.
he isn't. And he's an insurance company CEO. The guy's name is Dick Riley, and he's just fabulous. But Dick was commenting on how even in today's boardroom, many board members just are uncomfortable really pressing and asking hard questions. And they just don't feel comfortable about it. And they don't.
And it could be either, it could be a number of things, their own uncomfortableness with the topic, or they don't necessarily want to put senior management on the spot, I guess. I don't know.
Well, and people are always afraid. It's just people being people, but they're afraid that if you ask and really press on issue, other people won't like it.
Right.
And I've certainly sat on boards where there were people on the board that would do whatever they had to do to avoid confrontation. And I think that is still a major problem in our corporate boards today. I personally think, and I had this discussion with some people from boards here recently. I was just with a group of board people, including people from National Association of Corporate Directors, NACD, mm-hmm. and we were talking about it. And I think that we have probably got to go to having professional board members.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, like, boards hire
professional.
So some seats are professional board seats?
If not all of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'd probably make them all. I would go to professional directors because I found that you pull out so many people and they do one, maybe two boards, and they just don't have that ability to really go. They've got the ability, but it's not comfortable to them to go really press. And if you had a professional set of board members, there was some type of process to turn someone into this, you know, credential, then you'd be finding the people who, one, had the knowledge base within that company. You know, you look at the AIG board, you had five politicians on that board. I can tell you some of those politicians were clueless.
Well, they have knowledge, maybe not necessarily related to that company, but in the industry or in a discipline that's relevant to the company.
Yeah, well, and even on AIG board, I can understand why they might have a politician on there to help with Washington stuff. That makes all the sense, given they were the biggest insurance company in the world and global and working in a place like China. But five of them? Give me a break.
Yeah.
And at least one of them has been in trouble on other boards where there's been very significant blow-ups and investigations. So we ought to have a process that we get people who are able to ask, know what they're asking in that particular industry on the board and have shown an ability to ask the tough questions and hold people's feet to the fire in a tactful fashion. You don't want the board to turn into just a confrontational situation because it just can't function. That's not what you want. But you do want that person that's sitting there at AIG saying, you got to show me in a lot more detail exactly how those derivatives are working, and I want some modeling as to exactly what happens when things go south. Mm-hmm. And I do know no one was asking that question.
Well, it also seems to be potentially, because these companies are so large, someone inside on management who's not a board member, there are a person or a number of people who are responsible for it, presenting the information, pulling the information together for the boards. So
the top executives.
But you still think that the board members have a responsibility to probe as opposed to just be delivered information.
Let me turn it around. But the two institutions that I sit on, okay, so I'm sitting there in place on top of money for 450,000, 500,000 people. Okay, and we vote to elect these directors. When we vote to elect those directors, we're not electing a bunch of, you know, dumb guinea pigs just go walk in and vote. Mm-hmm. We want people overseeing that business and doing engaged oversight, asking, you know, are the strategies right, and challenging them if they don't seem to be what they should be. You know, I want to know that I've got a board that's asking about the compliance in mines. You know, I don't want to have to deal with, you know, a bunch of dead miners. That doesn't do me any good as an investor, and we've lost money in that investment. I want a board that turns around and really probes the management team on their compliance with the laws in this country in terms of mining safety and making sure we got the things in place and. You aren't sitting there trying to rationalize away why it's okay to have a methane buildup or, you know, BP.
Right.
You know, the problem with that, I have found that if the director doesn't probe and push on some of these issues, nothing happens. I know as a director, I can sit there and probe and make the executive feel accountable. He may not like it, or she may not like it, but I also know at the end of the day then I can drop it, because when I do that, they will go, they know that if there's a problem, they're going to get in trouble, so they'll go do something. If I don't push them on the issue, then they think it's okay not to worry about it.
As if the baton has been passed to the board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, wherever I've gone, we had an issue pop up in our board meeting yesterday, and I reminded this person, I said, look, if if there's a surprise, if there's a problem out there, you need to come to us on the board.
Right.
And first of all, come to us and tell us it's an issue and tell us what you think you ought to do. That's why you're there. We're not there to tell you what to do. You're there to tell us what you think you ought to do and what you want to go do. And as long as you bring that problem to us and we all agree on it, it's our problem. And if it blows up, we'll protect you till the cows come home. Mm-hmm. I'll go, you know, I'll fall on a sword for you. But as I was telling this person, I said, but if there's a surprise and I don't know anything about it, God won't be able to save your job. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we operate. And unfortunately, you got boards that operate just the opposite way. They don't know about things until they become surprises.
Yeah, until they're told by management, and it may be a surprise to management, but it's certainly a surprise to the board.
Yeah.
So the boards feel like they're finding out late in the game, so you have to ask.
We saw well,
did they ask enough questions?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Did they ask enough questions? Did they feel empowered? Is there some reason they didn't ask?
It's not just enough,
questions?
But it's asking the right questions, right. too. Are you smart enough to really...
Which gets back to...
Which, when you get into these financial institutions, you really got to be able to dig down into the loans and the lending quality and the quality of the underwriting. You got to know how the credit assessment process works if you're on the board and are people on top of it. Anyone that was on top of that should have been asking all the questions about this subprime stuff, especially at places like Wachovia and Countrywide, where they're doing brokerage on so many of them, HSBC. The other thing they should have been asking about then is on the securitizations, is they're keeping all the residuals, was just how the heck were they going to work off that? Because if you're hanging on to those residuals, I would have been out there asking, are you hedging at all? You know, if those things go, you make money by making loans and collecting interest. You don't make money in a bank by taking on a tremendous amount of risk. In fact, a good bank has really good asset liability management. So you try to hedge your risk on your assets with the positions you take on your liabilities. And typically, bankers will always tell you that got it almost 100% hedged, and the bottom line is they never do. It's more like 70%. And usually that means part of it is sitting over here in these residuals you're holding as an asset without a corresponding liability, such as if this declines, this will go up and you'll offset, and they just don't have it. So then the question becomes, have they got this adequately hedged?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously...
In some cases, we saw that they didn't, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. Exactly. If they'd had it hedged, and they certainly should have, because you make money banking is the old fact. It's true. You make money in banking the old-fashioned way by making good loans.
Mm-hmm.
When you start getting out, and this is where I'm a fan of the Paul Volcker stuff, when you get out and start getting into some of this trading and taking on this risk in banking, it just doesn't seem to work out. There's just something about it. It just doesn't seem to ever work out. So.
Okay. Other.
Alrighty.
Anything else? I know we've taken up a lot of your time today, Lynn.
Yeah. I have one quick question. I'm curious. Did you see Frank Partnoy's piece in the Financial Times? Oh, yeah.
Okay. I think we could. Okay. We're ending our.
Which piece was this?